Thank you, Allison, very much. It's a pleasure to be here, and good evening to everybody.
Today I'd like to talk about a very complex problem.
That is the problem of engineering and management of space travel. If this course were given on campus, we'd probably call it Space Appreciation 101. And I think everybody here would recognize engineering in space as one of the challenges of the 20th century, if not the challenge of the 20th century. And in my personal opinion, when you couple the engineering challenges with the management challenges, I'm just surprised the space shuttle flies, quite frankly. It's quite an ordeal to get all of these people and all of these things all working together and flying in formation, as you will. So I am actually impressed that this thing works, and I'm going to try to present to you today a little bit of background on how we get that all working. Now, it's hard enough to look at the engineering separately and the management separately, and you would think that it would be very nice to do in a suitably motivated environment, probably a private enterprise, but that's too easy. So we decided to do this under the auspices of a government. And for those of you who don't quite catch on to what I am speaking of, consider yourself lucky. For the rest of you, even working in the government wasn't challenging enough, so we decided to form a couple of partnerships with other governments, three or four or five, some of them democratic, some of them quasi-democratic. So it gets harder and harder every year. Well, I'd like to demonstrate tonight how to take an engineering project from conception to production. And I'll use the human spaceflight program as a foundation for that study. And in particular, I'll use a case study as an example. And it's just an example, but it's an easy way to express a few of the concepts that are used in integrating a smaller project with a very, very large project. And that is probably 80% of the engineering which occurs in the world anyway, so it would be a good lesson in that integration. Well, this is the agenda for tonight. In order to understand the what we call SAFER, by the way, that's the Simplified Aid for EVA, Rescue. Whenever I use the word EVA, and I'll try not to use it, but it's a habit, that means a spacewalk, extravehicular activity, EVA. Now we're going to look at how a particular engineering project is integrated into that very complex and orderly system. And we'll look at SAFER, the rescue jetpack that was flown on my last flight. First of all, a little bit of a program overview of SAFER, so you at least know what we're talking about. We'll describe the system, and then we'll look at the needs, what I call the program need statement. Basically, that's a client standing up and crying for help. And then the engineering community stepping up and solving the problem. And as you can see from this slide, it had to do with a hazard that the program wanted to avoid. And this is basically the unit that we're talking about. And I'm going to point it out to you because it's hard to see. This is an EVA crew member. And that is that little box tapped on the back of the suit is actually the unit I'm talking about. And so that is the new jetpack. It's hard to tell from this perspective, but that's it. And this is during the flight test itself. Now this part right here is part of the normal spacesuit. The part that we're talking about is this little part back here, which gives the EVA crew member mobility. As you can see, this is the looking towards the back of the space shuttle. There's the tail right there, and this is the mechanical arm, Earth in the background. So that's what we're talking about. And that little pack that I just pointed out is self-contained, and its purpose is to provide a rescue device so that if a crew member happens to become detached from the orbiter for some reason, he can manage to get himself back, if he loses a grasp, let's say. And as you can see from the stats right there, it's a very small little device. It has a single hand controller with about 3 switches on it and a line of displays. However, it does have a very sophisticated built-in test function. So if something goes wrong with it, it will kind of give you a little message up on your controller that there's something wrong. And here's where the client stood up and said, we need some help. And here's what they told us to do, and that is provide for the rescue of a EVA crew member who's become adrift in orbit. Essentially, it's a man overboard type of scenario. And this is not really a man overboard, but if he was overboard, this is what he'd look like. I think that's me on my first flight of the SAFER, on the first test flight. And you can see that, if I weren't planning to do this, I'd be a bit worried at this point. Now, let me tell you why this is... I'll tell you why this has become a problem. You may ask yourself, why haven't I heard about this before? But is this a credible threat? I'm going to tell you how currently we manage to stay attached to the orbiter. So I've used this picture. This is not from my mission, but from a previous mission where these two gents went out and this satellite was in an errant orbit. Its apogee kick motor had failed, and so it was in a useless low Earth orbit. It's supposed to be in geosynchronous orbit, and its motor fails. It was just kind of sitting there. And Lloyd's of London went to NASA and said, if you happen to be in the neighborhood and you see this satellite, please pick it up and bring it back. And so we did. And so now Lloyd's of London is a proud owner of an extra satellite. But this tether right here is how everybody is currently tethered. And I'm going to describe that to you. Now there's a waist ring around this guy right here, and there's a little D-ring. And attached to the D-ring, there's a tether hook. Attached to the tether hook, there's a fabric cloth strap, which has some, it's like a fuse. If you pull too hard on it, the fabric will start to rip so that you don't overstress your suit or the structure of the orbiter. So there's a fabric relief valve right there, and then there's this little take-up reel that has a metal cable in it, and you can barely see it, but there's a metal cable that runs back down to here, and actually it's running down and connecting to a slide wire that runs the fore and aft on the payload bay to allow the astronaut to go back and forth in the payload bay. So it's quite a daisy chain type of operation, and the question is, what could go wrong? Well, every once in a while something could go wrong. And let's look at what we've done so far. In the EVA world, in the spacewalk world, you can see from the slide that we've done quite a bit of experience, and we have a bit of experience in EVA, but we are expected to do a lot more if we build this International Space Station. If we build the International Space Station, it will require a lot of maintenance and a lot of hours. So what can go wrong with the system I just tried to explain to you, and that is that we can have a mechanical failure. We've actually had one of the tether hooks break on orbit, but it was discovered prior to the crew exiting the airlock so that they repaired it before they got outside, and then they modified their entire timeline so that because of the fact they could not undo this tether hook. So it was a big problem. So there are mechanical failures which can occur, and there can also be human failures. EVAs have been described as continual tether operations interrupted periodically by some useful work. And that is actually the case. There are a lot of tether operations involved, so you're continually making and breaking connections to the orbiter with your tether. And you can have an error. We have already had one U.S. astronaut actually lose his grip and be reeled back in by that mechanical reel that I showed you, that line, kind of like a fish on the end of a line, and a very undignified way to get back to the orbiter, but it beats the alternatives. And furthermore, the Russians have a slightly different system. They have a two-handed operation where they connect a tether and then another tether and then another tether and another tether, and they kind of leapfrog their way up. And one cosmonaut has become completely disconnected and lost his reach. And remember, if you're an inch away or a centimeter away, you're a centimeter too far because there's nothing that's going to get you back So he did lose control and started drifting away, called for help, and his partner came and rescued him right at the last moment, a very tense situation. So things can go wrong. Well, let's look at the history of let's look at the history of this vehicle here. As I said, you may wonder, we've done a lot of EVAs. Why is this a new problem? Why are we just hearing about this now? Well, the reason is, up until last month, actually, when the space shuttle docked with Mir, the space shuttle was always the backup. So if a crew member, an EVA crew member, lost his grip or became detached from the orbiter, the orbiter was always tasked with going to get him. Basically, the orbiter would chase him down and rescue the crew member. Well, imagine if you're attached to a space station, it takes about 12 hours to undock. So it's just too late. So if a person becomes detached, the orbiter cannot go to get them. And Lord knows that we're not going to pull up anchor on a 600-ton space station and chase down somebody, so we've got a real problem now. Now, we did consider other rescue devices. There are some schemes to have these little handheld little gun things where you could shoot a rod out and kind of grab the structure as you were floating away, and another little bolo thing you could throw, kind of like medieval apparatus, and all sorts of things were tested. And as a matter of fact, here's one of them. This is Ed White on the very first EVA in 1960s. This was on the Gemini program. And you notice, by the way, this is not a tether. This is an umbilical. Well, it serves as a tether, but it's also his oxygen supply, and he's connected to the ship all the time. But notice what he has in his hand. You see this little arm here? It has two jet nozzles on it, and he's holding this little handheld contraption. Right there is a bunch of nitrogen, so he has got a handheld little jet thing. And what he does is he points it in the direction he doesn't want to go, and he pulls the trigger, and then he goes the opposite direction. And he spent all day trying to get this to work, and it didn't work very well. So we tried it again on Skylab. And we had it in Skylab. This was 10 years later, and we had a similar sort of deal, and it didn't work very well either there. But it was cheap, you know, so that's why we tried it. And we didn't give up there. We tried it also on STS-49 10 years after Skylab, and it didn't work there either. But it was cheap. This is what we settled on. This cost $2.178 million American dollars, which is not cheap, but it works. So that's just part of the flight test right there. And it's often tempting to compare this with what we used to call the man-maneuvering unit, but it was the vehicle that we flew in the 80s to save all the satellites that you saw a minute ago. And notice how big this thing is, and I've got a 3 pages full of notes here that I've lost track of my notes, so you're lucky I'm not going to read them to you. But it just suffices to say that this is a huge vehicle, and it's doubly redundant. It's got two hand controllers, one for rotation, one for translation, and it's got about 30 feet of delta V, 30 feet per second. We measure fuel capacity in orbit in the capacity of changing your velocity. So it's got about 5 times the fuel capacity as the device that I tested, and it's doubly redundant, and it's a very capable machine. But it's mothballed because we just can't afford to fly it any longer.